Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Rachel.
I'm Ben.
And on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we unpick the boundary review and you ask us, what would Labour do to make wages fairer? As it's a quieter political week this week, I can see Rachel smiling. Yes, I did go away for the autumn statement and came back for the first quiet week in politics this year.
You look
sorry
so
about
healthy.
That. We thought we'd sort of zero in on something a bit geekier but very important, which is the boundary review. We've had the same constituency boundaries now since 2010 for all the parliamentary elections. And boundary commissions just seem to be that thing that never happens, like in 2013 and 2018. They were supposed to go through, but they never did.
Yeah, it's been like this mythical land that all of yes, Parliament is
a parallel universe that we can never quite reach.
You know, ooh, the boundary review, it will happen someday soon. But yeah, it's on now and we know where all of the new boundaries are probably likely to be.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get a feel for where all the bun fights that go with it within different political parties will be also.
Yeah, because we've got this new legislation that means there will be boundary reviews every 8 years. Mm. And the next one will be confirmed next year, although, as you say, the boundaries have been drawn up. And the number of parliamentary seats will stay at 650, because there was that plan under David Cameron to try and reduce them to 600. But obviously, that's just far too difficult to do.
Yes, and it gets split by population, basically. Yeah. And you have seats in the north, which will kind of expand, for example, because you've seen, you know, people go to live in some of the larger cities, and then you'll get extra constituencies in the more populated urban areas. It's generally thought that the boundary review overall will benefit the Conservatives more than it will Labour, just because of how the population levels break down. But I actually think Ben's done the most work on constituency boundaries.
Yeah, of anyone.
Yeah.
And luckily we do have him here, Ben. I mean, I was reading some analyses of these new seats or the sort of remapping of the political map. And one analysis said the Tories would actually gain 13 seats from this and Labour would lose 8. And that's because a lot more seats are being made in the south because of that demographic change that Rachel was talking about. Will it really be that bad? And is there more going on under the surface?
Yeah, thanks for having me as well. This is the thing, 13 more Conservative seats. I estimate between 8 and maybe 15 more. It depends on how you do what we call notional results. You know, trying to guess how these seats would vote on new boundaries is a little bit difficult, to be fair. The new seats mostly come in the commuter belt, Commuterville. Okay, and what do you expect there? What that means is seats on the last boundaries on the elections of 19, 17, 15, 10 have just basically become too large. So really, they need shrinking in geographic size because there's too many people there. And what that means is places such as Wickham in Buckinghamshire, places such as the south of Swindon in Wiltshire, they were once quite, you know, they had quite rural bits. Now they've become quite urban. And what does that mean? On paper, they're still Conservative, but they're a lot more marginal. So the boundary changes, yes, they're necessary. And for those listening that think it's gerrymandering, it's not. It's done by an independent body. It's nonpartisan. You don't need to. This isn't America. Thank goodness for that, because they are absolutely terrible over there. No, really, it's completely neutral. It's good. It occasionally gets submissions from local people, although here in Chester, our seat is cut up right down the middle, which annoys a great many of us here. Yeah, the net benefit is in the Conservatives' favour, but it reflects the reality, which is that there are just a lot more commuter seats in England that need reflecting. And it's worth bearing in mind as well is that the boundaries that we currently fight the elections on overrepresent Welsh and Scottish MPs. There are more Wales and Scotland seats than there are as a share of the population, if that makes sense. So this boundary of you sort of reverts that to know if your share of the population equals, you know, your share of the seats. Something to bear in mind, I know I'm going on a tangent here, but something that we often forget is that these seats are constructed according to voters, not people in the seats. So if you live in London, if you're an MP in London, you are going to have a very large migrant population that can't vote and don't go into the equation. But, you know, you'll have 80,000 voters, but you'll probably have about 100, 120, 130,000 people living there. And what that means is you'll have a lot more casework. You know, if you're an urban London MP or an urban MP with a lot of migrants, a lot of people who don't vote, you have a lot more casework than, say, a seat like Chester.
Really. Yes. Yeah, it's so interesting, the different seats. I mean, all of us will have done those kind of articles where you go around with an MP around their constituency, and they're so different, aren't they? You know, talking about those inner city urban seats that you just mentioned, the amount of work in those and the nature of the work is so different. But then you go to seats like, I remember Copeland during the Copeland by-election, which is just this absolutely enormous constituency. And so the work of actually getting around it for an MP, that's quite hard, even if the casework perhaps isn't as intense as, say, in Tottenham, for example. And as a journalist who doesn't actually have a driving license, I ran up a lot of taxi bills covering that by-election for the New Statesman. So yeah, sorry, finance. But are there any seats that you're looking out for? Because I was having a look through them, and there are some that are quite interesting. Bristol Central is causing a lot of excitement among the Green Party. It looks like it could probably be a surefire thing for Carla Denyer, who is a co-leader of the Green Party. That's her patch. And, you know, that would be quite a good thing for the Greens, because they would double their number of parliamentary seats if they won that one. And then you can see a few others. It looks like the Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross's seat of Murray could turn SNP.
Maybe that's why he's standing down.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this can have all sorts of political implications in terms of politicians' decisions. Tim Farron, you know, former Lib Dem leader's seat, Westmorland and Lonsdale, could go Conservative. And then, of course, talking of former leaders, there's Uxbridge and South Ruislip, which is a outer London seat that's undergone a lot of demographic change anyway, Boris Johnson's seat. And that, I mean, I grew up near there, and Northolt could be added to that seat, which is a Labour town, and that could make it even more likely that that seat goes Labour next time around. But I'd be interested in hearing from both of you what's caught your eye.
Oh my God, there's tons. And to be honest, everything you say is actually interesting. There's been a development, right? This is the thing. Boundary changes go through multiple reviews. So there's a bunch of sessions. The Boundary Commission puts out, you know, their proposals, and then they let the public have their opinion, which is often, this is absolutely SHI, you know, go on so forth. It's terrible. Tim Farron's Westmorland and Lonsdale seat, that it was absolutely killer. And then, after a great deal of complaints from the locals, and indeed Mr. Farron himself, the seat is basically saved. He's okay, just about, I think. Now, okay. Bristol Central is the exciting one, I think, because the Greens do really well locally there. The local organisers I speak to sort of concede that Labour doesn't make as much of an effort in the local elections, because they've sort of conceded the wards to the Greens already. Now, in Bristol Central, for those who don't know Bristol that well, before, the seat was called Bristol West and included basically the train station, a little bit to the east of that, and then the entirety of the west going up to the bridge. What's the bridge name? I forget. I've only been to Bristol once, but you know what I mean. Anyway, what Bristol Central is now, even though it's quite western, is it's just entirely represented by Green councillors. And that yeah, poses some trouble for Thangam Debonair, who, to be fair, has a stonking majority, even in 2019 as well, after the Labour surge in 17. So honestly, I don't know. I wouldn't say shoo-in, because the thing is, Debonair is quite popular. Debonair has profile there, and when she stands down, then I think it's up for grabs. I just don't know, but yes, definitely want to watch. Ben Wallace, he represents a seat which right now is called Weir and Preston North. That gets carved up between Ribble Valley and Lancaster and Weir. And Lancaster and Weir risks becoming quite a bit of a battleground. That's currently, is it Kat Smith, who's the MP for Lancaster and Fleetwood, yep, I think? Yeah, and she could be in a spot of trouble, because her seat, instead of being more urban, becomes a bit more rural. So there's a bit of trouble for there, absolutely. Swindon South, another one to watch out for, because it becomes a lot more urban. That is Robert Buckland's seat. It's a bit of a tough fight, because it's one of those commuterville, one of those consumer-type seats that did swing Labour quite starkly in the local elections of May this year. We definitely want to watch there. The Lib Dems could cause a bit of a surprise in Kent, of all places. Maidstone was once very rural, quite a rural seat, now becomes a lot more urban. Maidstone and Malling Labour could make a bit of a comeback in the Isle of Thanet, of all places, the seat Nigel Farage once stood there. Instead of North Thanet, South Thanet becomes East Thanet, which is basically just Ramsgate through to Margate, the very urban built-up bits. But that is, according to people on the ground, really dependent on the Labour campaign actually getting its act together. Occasionally, often doesn't. No, there's definitely tons to watch out for. It makes things a lot more exciting because we're fighting on new boundaries. What else can I say, really? Wales, there's not much to say. In Scotland, yes, Douglas Ross, basically, his seat is gone in Moray. The SNP benefit from the boundary changes in Scotland. The Lib Dems lose one in Caithness and I think North East 5-2, but only by the slimmest of margins. Yeah, it's exciting, I think. Well, it's exciting to me. I don't know if it's exciting to listeners and my colleagues.
It is. But I'm glad you mentioned about Labour getting its act together, because, Rachel, you had some detail in one of your recent pieces about how there is still some expectation that there could yet be a snap election. And so Labour haven't redistributed their organisers around the new boundaries yet.
Yeah, it was kind of a peculiar little development at NEC this week. The National Executive Committee, sort of Labour's main ruling body. So they had some months ago decided to start organising all of their activists around these new boundary changed constituencies, but have now delayed that until the summer on the sort of outside chance that it could all fall apart for Rishi Sunak and they end up having to go for a snap election. Whereas I kind of think previously, when Sunak first got into the role, that was, you know, not considered to be
a prospect.
Yeah, a prospect at all. But yeah, it's still being factored in there, which makes me slightly nervous.
And how else is the looming boundary commission affecting political decisions? You mentioned sort of Douglas Ross's decision to stand down, for example, and also that there can be bun fights even between those in the same party over the new patches that appear.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it everywhere you look, really. Labour's selection process is complicated by the fact that it's becoming controversial for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you look across the Conservative Party as well, you'll see a number of MPs standing down because they think, well, you know, I don't fancy my chances, especially not looking at the polls. So yeah, I think you'll see it play out in greater detail in the few months ahead.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you so much, both. I think that was a really good whip round the new boundaries, and we'll of course be visiting all of these new seats in due course. One thing I did want to ask you about quickly before we move on to the second section, Ben, is I noticed on your map there's this weird sort of exclave in Cambridge. It's the Nagorno-Karabakh of the fens. Will these kind of little strange nobules which split constituencies up be sort of ironed out before the final commission is decided?
Probably not. The Boundary Commission say they take submissions from residents, but they have been. This was included. Right, okay, for those who don't know, Cambridge has its own seat, and surrounded to the northeast of it is East Cambridgeshire. And if you know where Cambridge North train station is, let's assume you do, there's a sewage works next to it, okay? Now, Cambridge North train station, which is north of the sewage works, is in the Cambridge city seat. But south of the station is a sewage works, which is in East Cambridgeshire. And it's not connected to East Cambridgeshire at all, save for a little river, which is a little bit odd. There's another one as well. Chris Bryant's seat in the Rhondda takes in this tiny little, this weird shape. I asked him, like, are you going to object to that? And he said, nah, don't bother. Why? What's the point? He's like, it's done. He was very dry when he gave that answer. Yeah, there's a lot of things like this that get thrown up. It's the reality of trying to build boundaries based on some pretty strict rules. I object to the rules quite strongly. I think you're trying to build these representative, decent seats using huge wards, like, you know, 18,000. And you're setting yourself a rule, 65,000 voters to 75. That's how big the seat should be, okay? And there are some wards that are as big as 18, 20, 25. You can't really build decent seats out of that, but it's happening. What can we do?
Spoken like a man who has wearily been through every permutation of these new seats. All right, well, thanks, Ben. Let's move on to the next section.
Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward, and Rachel Weirmouth. featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Today, our question is from an anonymous listener who we like to believe is a woman, who asks, how would Labour solve the wage crisis? So I think this is probably a reference both to various workers going on strike, but also what they would do when they come into power to make wages fairer. The latest news on this is that more than 10,000 ambulance workers have voted to go on strike.
Yeah, I mean, God, it's just kind of like really hard to keep up with just how many people are going on strike now. I've noticed that sort of when we send the morning email that I'll get quite a few out of office replies saying, oh, hi, I'm not here today because I'm taking industrial action. Yeah. So what we have, nurses, ambulance staff. Oh, God, it's just like the list is so long. What would Labour do about Lil Pitt? I mean, their position is not really a position at all, as is quite often the case with Labour. They're not recommending any kind of particular percentage when it comes to sort of individual employers. They kind of say, you know, it goes to a peer review body. Their position is kind of like, well, you should pay nurses properly. And I mean, like, that could mean a million different things, right?
Yeah.
But they do have quite a good policy on the minimum wage, which they say is kind of aimed at tackling structural low pay. And it asks the Low Pay Commission basically to peg the minimum wage to the cost of living, basically. And it also, and this is kind of the interesting bit of the policy for me, I think, it also extends the blanket rate to younger workers, to sort of 18 to 22 year olds, so that that's supposed to tackle where low wages start, basically, at the beginning of someone's career. And that's an element that the government would have control over, you know, setting the national minimum wage. Yeah. So that's their response. But when it comes to sort of strikes and all the ones that we're seeing, they don't have a very hard and fast position on a particular rate that they would give to, say, nurses or, say, to ambulance workers.
Mm. And I suppose that position does make sense sort of practically, because they're not in the negotiations. There does have to be a pay review body process. But it makes it difficult in those short radio interviews when they'll say, well, the government should be helping nurses not have to use food banks. And they say, well, how much would you pay them? And they don't have an answer. And it does bring about some of that politician's language and the sort of the shifty sounding non-answers that I suppose Labour should be trying to avoid at this stage when they want to look like a government in waiting. And I'd be interested to hear what sort of public sentiment is about strikes at the moment, because one of the reasons why they didn't want to fully oppose the rail strikes, for example, or at least some in Shadow Cabinet didn't want to, was because they wanted to keep open the prospect of supporting nurses striking when that would inevitably happen, and teachers and other professions that have a bit more public sympathy. Mm-hmm. Ben, have you been looking into those polling figures at all?
Yeah, you're completely right. Nurses gain a lot more sympathy from voters, and it's quite stark. So I've got a bit of a theory. You'll notice that... When was the first strike? I think I asked this question at the Cambridge Literary Fest. I think it was March, April, May. I can't remember. You know, support for the strike was only 38, 40%. And opposition to it was like 45, close to 50. Then we got to September, October, November. Support for the strike just pipped opposition for the first time. But now it's drifted back a little bit. And I get the impression that, you know, over the course of the past 10, 15 or so years, when voters think of trains striking, they often think of tube strikes, if you know what I mean. They think of Bob Crow. Mm. They think of that sort of thing. And I do wonder if the narrative of tube workers get a decent pay, so all trade staff get a decent pay. And that's why I wonder maybe the sympathy isn't as high as perhaps for other professions. Well, anyway, here's what you need to know. 40% of voters in this country support the strike by rail workers. 45% have sympathy, so it's more of a quite divided nation on it. When it comes to nurses, however, which is a bit more unanimous, I suppose, or overwhelming, perhaps, 71% of Britons have sympathy were the nurses striking. 60% support them striking. Notice the difference. Notice how the numbers are different. Doctors as well, 65% sympathy, 54% support. Barristers, interesting enough, 19% sympathy.
I suppose that's because, you know, the majority of people hopefully don't have to use a barrister.
Yeah. Considering, you know, journalists are among the most unpopular professions, I think this kind of tells us what, if we were ever considering to go on strike, where we'd probably sit.
Yeah.
Very annoyed that journalists haven't been included in this poll. They haven't been asked. What if journalists went on strike? Would you support them?
And there have been journalists striking, actually. Some journalists at Reach have been on strike. Rachel, Rishi Sunak is still using this line. He used it at this week's PMQs, trying to sort of say that Labour is still at the hands of the union paymasters and Keir Starmer doesn't have control over his own MPs going on picket lines. Why does he keep saying that? I mean, it sounds to us as journalists who watch this stuff all the time like a really old sort of passé attack, but is it something that does sort of gain political traction when they use it?
Considering where the country is at the minute and how many people are on strike, are about to go on strike, it feels really, really dated, doesn't it?
It feels
like, you know, something that belongs in an entirely different election campaign rather than the one that we're about to face, which comes after, you know, a very long period of austerity, a lot of workers very, very exhausted and having to put up with terrible working conditions. On the other hand, I wonder if part of his thinking is to lay the groundwork for a situation where these strikes continue and there is some public frustration with the amount of disruption that people might have to put up with. But it's also just the Conservatives shrinking back into their base and hoping to hang on to the seats that they do have. Just when we were on about pay, I was going to kind of bring up a little point that I think often a lot of these strikes are about working conditions and come after, you know, a long pandemic where a lot of workers feel quite exhausted, particularly those who've been working in the public sector and who've been very relied on during COVID, particularly those in the NHS or ambulance workers or nurses who just kind of don't feel appreciated and would like a bit of kind of give in their job.
Absolutely. I'm really glad that you mentioned that because I think a lot of people look at who the worker is who's striking and then look up the average salary for that worker. And if it's higher than theirs, then they think, oh, well, you know, they should be happy with their lot. But actually, a lot of this isn't about pay, especially not these paramedics who, many of whom I've spoken to, who have spent entire shifts, you know, 12-hour shifts with one patient in the back of an ambulance outside a hospital. And for them, that's very bad working conditions because they're getting through on their radio calls to go and drive their ambulance to people who are in immediate danger. And they can't do that because they still have to hand their patient over to the emergency department. And for them, that makes them feel like they can't do their jobs properly. One of them described it to me as a moral injury every time that happens. And so, you know, if you think about if you're a labourer, you get injured physically at work, but this is a moral injury for them. And so that is part of the reason why they feel like they cannot continue working unless something changes. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, it's an important point, isn't it? And it's one that people miss because they just look at the numbers and think, oh well, that they might be slightly better off than me. But when you think about, you know, every job is different and what the threshold of what people are willing to cope with or able to cope with has probably been broken a few times during the pandemic.
Yeah. And Ben, what do we know? Do we think that frustration with strikes, particularly if they happen on the trains over Christmas, do you think that will affect the sort of public sentiment about them?
I call it mood music. If the mood music is about a country in chaos, then the government is perceived to be unable to handle the chaos, to be able to, you know, counter the chaos. And so perceptions of competence are just, I would expect, decline already from the low level it is already at. This is the thing. It's already behind on the economy by a few percentage points, 10, 15, about a few months ago. It's Labour's lead on the issue has drifted downwards a little bit because Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister. They are behind on competence, they're behind on the economy, they're behind on so many of the key indicators that, you know, gave the Conservative brand such a positive vibe with enough voters. They are in the doldrum. I know I kept saying Liz Truss was rock bottom, but the Conservative brand is at rock bottom. And I think, you know, if you've got strike, some voters may come to the conclusion that this is, you know, oh, those lefties are they're problematic, you know. But I think really if the government's not handling it, the government's presiding over a contraction in living standards and disruption on trains, at work, in the hospitals. It's going to land at the feet of the government. And the share of Britons who blame the government for a lot of these strikes, to be honest with you, is almost close to majority figures. A good number also blame the unions. I don't think many people blame the Labour Party, despite the fact it's bad. It's going to get worse, and it's not favouring them at all. And just something on nurses as well. It's worth bearing in mind, nurses are still paid 2% less in real terms than they were in 2010. They haven't exactly had anything in the shape of a pay rise. You know, it's context is needed here, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's fascinating that there's almost a complete set of numbers of people who are blaming the government for the strikes. That's really fascinating.
Yeah,
I didn't realise it was quite that high.
Probably not a good thing to bring up at PMQs then, in that case. <I know. laughs> If you're listening, Rishi Sunak. All right, well, thanks so much, both of you. It's really good to be back in the studio, and thanks for joining me. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues Rachel Wearmouth and Ben Walker. We're produced by May Robson, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to leave us a nice review and subscribe. And if you want to submit a question to You Ask Us, you can go to newstatesman.com/YouAskUs.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.